Welcome to Pod to the Rescue, a podcast from Summit Dog Rescue in Boulder, Colorado.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Libby.
We're both professional dog trainers with multiple certifications in dog training and behavior. Together, we have more than two decades of experience in dog rescue.
We want to share everything we've learned along the way with other folks involved in dog rescue, sheltering, fostering, and adoption, and anyone who just loves dogs.
Rescuing the dog is just the first step.
We're here to help with everything that comes next. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Pod to the Rescue. I'm Libby.
And I'm Emily.
And today we are bringing you part two of our interview with Sarah Strumming of the Cognitive Canine and Cog Dog Radio. We spoke to her about adolescence in dogs. It was a wonderful conversation. If you haven't yet listened to that first part, go back and have a listen. We think it's going to be a really, really helpful for a lot of our listeners.
We hope you enjoy it, and we're so excited you're back for part two.
And again, we'll link in the show notes of this episode Sarah's course, Teenage Tyrants, as well as some other resources to help you better understand canine adolescence. I would love to shift a little bit and potentially pick on, say, herding dogs for a minute. I have a herding dog. I know you have herding dogs. But it's actually a broader question. Are there certain breed-specific behaviors that we might see emerge more at adolescence? Like, are herding dogs nipping and chasing us in circles around the house?
Well, first of all, they're the easiest group to pick on, I think. Yeah, definitely. I'm a border collie person, just for better or worse, and a lot of times worse. But yes, we start to see expression of breed typical traits a lot of times during this phase. And when we think about breed typical traits, what I don't think we talk about is that what those traits are things that emerge under stress. So border collies do not exhibit herding behavior when they are sleeping on the couch. They don't exhibit herding behavior usually when you're preparing their food and putting it in a bowl and putting it on the ground. They start to exhibit the behaviors that I lovingly refer to as SSPS, which is sticky, stocky bull. I don't know what I'm allowed to say on this podcast.
Whatever.
Yeah. Sticky, stocky bullshit is what I lovingly refer to those behaviors as, where they freeze up and they stare and they stalk and they might charge in and bite if the staring and the stalking does not work. They outrun, they do all of these things kind of depending on who they are and what their particular genetic cocktail is. But those behaviors emerge due to a stressor. They don't emerge just out of thin air, and they don't emerge under kind of happy, happy, joy, joy circumstances. So similarly, you might have like a livestock guardian, because I know that we have also have that going on the podcast, mm-hmm. who the livestock guardian typical type behavior of patrolling, of like circling an area and barking, also emerges due to stressors in the environment, does not emerge just out of thin air. So what happens in adolescence is things start to become more apparent to them in the environment, therefore certain stressors start to emerge in the environment. And then what might happen is those traits that are kind of buried in there are what tell them how to respond. So if we go to a really common type of stressor, like we've been talking about trucks and cars and whatever, but traffic is really hard for dogs, actually. Like walking next to a street with moving cars is actually a big ask that we ask of a lot of them. So the way that the dog responds to traffic, usually as little puppies, if you're paying attention, you will see that they're a little nervous about it. But kind of depending on who they are, you might see it as blatant fear and avoidance, or you might see it as little ears are a little bit pinned and eyes are a little bit tight and we're just a little bit furrowed brow and kind of concerned about this. But like I'm thinking cute little, I'm thinking like lab golden crossbred for service work that's trotting along. And he's like, a little worried about that, but like, okay. And continuing to walk on versus you might have border collie puppy dart to the end of the leash to try to escape the traffic when their baby, that same border collie puppy, age 7 months, is trying to stalk and chase the cars. And so when we think about breed typical stuff, of course, considering the individual is really important. And of course, a lot of times when we're dealing with rescue dogs, we don't actually know what they are. And we're making a broad strokes guess. And turns out now that we do have powers like Embark, we're finding out how wrong we are a lot of the time about what they are. And so it's just really important, I think, to look at the individual and see what it is that they're doing in response to those stressors. And yeah, if you bought the thing on purpose and you know what kind of thing it is, or you rescued it on purpose and you know what it is, knowing what behaviors are likely to emerge under stress is, I think, the question about dogs that people aren't asking when we're talking about breeds of dogs. You know, for instance, like, it's kind of hot right now. I don't know if you've noticed, for people to get a Belgian Malinois. It's kind of a...
They're all over the shelters. Yeah. You can get one at any shelter.
Terrible. You can get one on any shelter. You can get one on Craigslist. You can get one on Facebook Marketplace. You can get one wherever you want. And what I would love for everybody to know is that the Belgian Malinois under stress would like to bite something. That's what they have been. You know, there's kind of a breed split, obviously, that we don't need to get into, but the ones that are circulating are the ones that for the last lots and lots of years have been designed to have that response to stress. And so that's an important thing for people to maybe know. And then maybe yours doesn't. And maybe for yours, that manifests as, this is going to be kind of hard for you. Would you like to carry this toy through this situation so that you can bite and thrash that toy? Versus my border collies that want to control the movement with their eyes and their movement, teaching them a whole lot of other skills that get them the same results that are actually usable for us is my responsibility and my job. If I have them, it's not okay for my border collie to see a dog on the horizon on the trail and to go into a down and stare at it and stalk it, because that's really scary for the normal dog that's on the trail. And it's probably scary for the person. Like, it's just not a socially appropriate thing to do. It's my job to teach them other ways of being and other things to do in those scenarios. So it's basically, as you see them figuring out their world, you will see them experience stressors and you will see expression of behaviors due to those stressors. And if that expression can be channeled elsewhere, like letting them carry a toy, that's fantastic. If it really can't, it is your job to teach them a robust set of skills that they can actually access in those other times. But same with like really anything. You've got a terrier that never used to dig and now at 10 months old, is digging 5 million holes in the backyard and the people are frustrated. And then that's when they surrender the dog or whatever. Yeah. Those things really do start to emerge during that time.
Oh my gosh. Listening to you, I just feel like we're never going to put rescues and shelters out of business because it's just really hard to get dogs through adolescence. And I'm also thinking that puppy preparation has to change in this country because I do like, I see clients, you know, and people think they do one puppy class where the dog knows sit and maybe down and like, that's it. Like you can make it till the dog is 12 with those two skills or, you know, like we need to start as rescues and shelters and as a society, really relaying this information because you keep saying skills, 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 but people don't even teach them a reliable sit, you know, not that I really think that is important, but you know what I mean? Like I'm about to explode over here. So I'm going to pass it back to you.
I do know what you mean. I was just saying to my friend, Liza, that I was like, I want a free manual that teaches people how to get a dog that's actually going to work for them in their life, that literally is the first thing that shows up on Google when they try to find a puppy, when they try to find a dog. Because I think if you labeled them like, this one's super user-friendly, this one, you probably can go to puppy class and then be okay. Or if you say this one, less user-friendly, like you're going to need to plan on staying enrolled for 1 to 2 years, right? And I think it'd be safe for us to just tell everybody plan on staying enrolled for 1 to 2 years in some training. I think it's the perception of, well, I think there's a longstanding perception of like, well, dogs are easy to have. Like, well, I've had dogs my whole life. Like my parents had, like, they're easy. Like, what do? You stick them in the backyard, you feed them some brown cereal. Like they're fine. Like
those are the ones who lived past right. adolescence. Adolescence. The other ones are all dead.
A little bit of a survival mechanism there. And it's true. And I think that, I mean, we could really get into some sociology here that we don't have to get into, but like, it is, I think that the solution is more dogs that are actually suitable for people's homes, because that's not the kind of dog we have an excess of. And so that's where I, you know, work closely with Functional Dog Collaborative and work really hard with like trying to support people who are on that kind of mission. And then also, yeah, what do we do with these dogs that are here? I think we educate and help and hold up the foster homes, because having them out of shelters and in foster homes is the best thing for them. And really helping those foster people who are going to, like, if I just fostered an adolescent, like back-to-back adolescents, I would never have my own dogs because I would be exhausted. Right. Like they're tough.
They're so tough. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
I feel like we could talk about this all day, and I kind of want to, but I want to be respectful of your time as well. Do you have time for like a couple more questions?
Yeah, I do. Okay. Go ahead.
Awesome. So we've talked a lot about how to support adolescent dogs in some ways we can help them learn that they are safe. What are some other top skills you think we need to teach our adolescent dogs or puppies going okay. into adolescence?
Bingo. I have a class called Teenage Tyrants. I sell it on my own platform now. I'll make sure and get you guys that link. When I taught it through FDSA and I had people enrolled and talked to them about it, because it's self-study now, people would always say, well, I don't need that. My puppy's 3 months. And I would say, no, this is the perfect time. Please come into the class. So yes, little baby puppies on the cusp of adolescence are like ideal to teach all these things to. So I like to teach them. I really like to teach them a suite of skills that they can then lean on in these times of stress or kind of high arousal. So those skills would be, I like to teach them to be confined and actually to be relaxed in confinement. I think being relaxed in confinement is kind of basically a make or break situation. You guys being involved in rescue, I'm sure know that like if the dog can chill in a crate, the dog's chances of a good outcome for its life are much, much higher than a dog that is immediately upset the second you put them in a crate or even behind a gate, right? So I have a whole program where I teach them that the crate is basically a cue to relax. I do the same thing with a tether. That's a newer one for me. And I'm very aware of like the different dogs' responses. Some dogs are much more able to relax on a tether than they are in a crate, and vice versa is also true. So kind of being aware of what's happening in front of you is important there. But I also do it on a tether. I do a whole lot of really intentional use of things that are natural for them that they kind of already did as puppies. So for instance, chewing. So if I provide you a chewing opportunity and that's kind of always attached to a relaxation situation, I can then take that into other situations. So something that Carson is doing right now is we go to a weekly training practice where we're all kind of doing our own thing. And she is not super capable of doing the sport type behaviors that I'm teaching her in that environment. But what she's doing is I sit on the sidelines with her on a leash with a bone, and she just lays there and chews on it. So she's learning I can self-soothe and relax in this scenario. I don't need to scream. I don't need to bark. I don't need to have my arousal go through the roof. I can lay here and chew this bone. So the reason she can do that is because of how much sitting around and chewing we did when she was a puppy. So she goes, oh, I know this one. Right. Okay. I can lay down and chew this bone. So being able to kind of chew in a variety of situations, if they already can't lay down and chew something like in the easy circumstance, it's not something you can take on the road yet, but that's also telling. They're having a hard time relaxing if they can't lay down and chew something, because laying down and chewing something is how a dog kind of naturally relaxes, especially when they're young. And so that's, I see it as a skill. It's like, okay, well now we're having chew time where everybody's just going to have something and lay down and chew it. If you have multi-dog households, it's super important that you do this all together, but you can obviously do it with barriers to keep everybody safe if you need to. Along the same lines, I do a whole lot of what I just call reinforcer skills, but it's basically skills of eating. So I teach them the cue scatter means I'm going to throw a handful of food. I'm very careful not to build arousal into that behavior. So I don't throw food on like linoleum or concrete or anything like that. I throw it in grass, and dirt. And being able to go from running around crazy with the other dogs to stopping and doing a scatter is that kind of like emotional regulation that I want them to access all just as a regular part of their day. So that if we go back to that, I got myself in a bad situation and there was a big truck scenario. I wait for the truck to be gone. I wait for my puppy to come down a notch. Then we get out of Dodge. When I see the puppy shake off, I'm now going to do a scatter. That's when I'm going to bring food into the scenario. Now the puppy's going to go, oh, okay, I'm regulating even more. I'm bringing myself down enough to just snuffle. And like the second I'm accessing grass, we're doing a scatter. We're bringing everybody down. As well as other ways to take food from me. So I have a cue that means eat from my hand and another one that means I'm tossing one piece of food on the ground. It can be the same cue as long as your kind of visual cues are different. Dogs are really, really good at picking that stuff up. So it doesn't need to be different words. Those are the primary things. I also teach them, I work really hard on skills of being physically guided. So I take your collar and I move you from here to here. Because I run into something in adolescence that I can't believe we haven't touched on yet, that I think is really, really vital, which is the difference between a choice and a no choice type of scenario. Basically, I don't want to give my adolescent choices unless I know for sure the choices are choices I'm fine with. So this is the age where they're not going to come inside from outside when you call them. They're going to start to avoid the car at the end of the walk. They're not going to want to get in. They're not going to want to go in the crate at bedtime. All these things are really normal. When you start to see those things emerge, remove all the choices. Now we're dragging a long line outside, so I could just reel you in and I don't need to call you, because what is a choice? A choice is, in this scenario, what I'm saying is basically if I want the dog to do something and I ask them to do it, that is a choice, because I've, you know, if I trained you to go lay on your mat with positive reinforcement with food, then when I say, hey, go settle, that is a choice for you. You can choose to go settle and earn food or not. A no choice scenario is a negative reinforcement contingency. Basically it's, I'm going to make sure that you do it. I'm going to make sure that you get in the car, rather than ask you to get in the car and try to lure you and bribe you in the car with food. I'm going to make sure that you come inside when it's time to come in, rather than ask you or lure you or have to go chase you down. So when they're young and they're not super resistant to stuff, I'm moving them all over the place with their collar, with their leash. I'm asking them to put a leash on when they might think that that's a stupid idea. I'm putting leashes on, I'm taking them off, I'm moving the dog by the collar. So I'm doing lots of essentially restraint types of things so that they're comfortable with it. Because if a dog has never been moved into, say, a car by being lifted, they might panic about just being lifted. And now you've got a problem with the car. So if I practice lifting and moving by the collar and all of those things way before I need to make sure that you do the things I need you to do, we're in better shape. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So I would say, and then also, of course, like there's a whole set of skills that go with off-leash reliability, which is basically a whole other podcast that I'm working really, really hard on in that time frame. But suffice it to say that it's engagement with me outside. Like anytime we are out and about in the world and you pay attention to me, I make sure that that pays. And I do that starting very early. And then I usually increase the payment through adolescence. Like you're getting higher value payouts for that a lot of the time, because I know that it's harder for you to do when you start to hit that age.
Hmm. That's so fascinating. Just hearing you talk about it all, I think about all the people who like have never worked on engagement, or like not, no fault of their own. I don't want to sound judgy,
yeah.
But you know, they haven't worked on engagement. You know, they've done one class and then they want recall at 8 months old when it's probably the hardest time. So yeah. I love like the whole concept of teaching those skills at 3 months of age to the human and the dog, and then working yeah. on them and building them.
And it's not, and I just want to be clear for our listeners, it's not if you're adopting your dog at 1 year or a year and a half, it's not too late to work on all these skills. These are still important skills to work on.
Absolutely. And you start where you are, right? And if you adopt a one-year-old dog, consider this a blank slate. They need to learn all of these things as well. And it's really not too late. And in fact, they don't have a history with you. So you're new to them. Just start where you are. Don't worry about so much what they learned before. Don't worry about, I don't know if you guys look at it differently, but I don't even want people to really think about any like the bad experiences this dog had. I just want just think about it as day to day, you're learning who they are and they're learning who you are. And who you want to be is a person who's got really good ideas, who it really pays off to pay attention to.
Mm-hmm. What a great opportunity. No, I'm with you. I'm with you on the whole speculating about a rescue dog's past. We have no way of knowing what this dog has learned, what they've experienced, what their previous environment was like. And what good does it do us? You know, all we can handle is the moment in front of us.
Yeah.
I tell people when they even buy a puppy, like if you are in a situation where you are seeking out a puppy from like a breeder, you're very smart to think of every single thing as being genetic and a done deal when you buy this thing. It isn't though. If you think about it that way, you'll select your breeder and your pedigrees smart. Then once you have it, now it's all on you. So Hannah Brannigan said on her podcast, she likes to say, before you get the puppy, everything's genetic. After you get the puppy, nothing is. So think about, I think we could reframe that into adopting an adult or an adolescent rescue dog as nothing is genetic and nothing is the dog's past. Like everything is right now forward. All of that stuff is there. But if you don't even know what it is, just go forward with the behavior that's in front of you.
That makes sense. I got my Pyrenees when she was 14 months old, and I did know some of her previous history. I got her straight from her people, but I didn't really spend that much time thinking about it. Now I see some behaviors. I'm like, well, that would make a little bit of sense given her breed and where she grew up. But it was just fresh slate, threw the prong collar away and ran over the shock collar with my car and, you know, just started her fresh, you know, and she became my soulmate.
Yeah.
Warts and all.
How cool that that can happen. Like it's, yeah. You don't need to worry about it. And you also can just, you know, people, if I didn't know anything about Carson and I walked her down the road and she panicked about something, I could make a whole story about what must have happened to her. And actually, it's just really normal for an adolescent dog to freak out about stuff that they've never even seen before. So I think that probably is true for people as well when they've adopted a dog and they kind of go, well, it's that classic, like he was abused by men with hats on or whatever, when actually it's just kind of not normal for people to have a weird thing on their head. And like dogs see it. And they, I mean, the first time one of my dogs saw a parent like holding their child up on their shoulders, my dog like puts on the brakes, is like, what's going on with this? Like, it's so normal for them to go, I've never seen that before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to process it, especially when they're adolescents. And if we're not careful, we can make too many stories about why they're responding that way. And then we might not be the trainers that we need to be for that dog going forward.
So there is a light at the end of the tunnel. Can we just briefly, I feel like we've been really doom and gloom, and I don't want people to be like, I'm never going to get a dog that's not 15 years old. So like, can you talk a little bit about what happens when you get to the other side, if you've taught these skills, and you might have a few little things you still need to work on, but tell us what you think.
Yeah. So there absolutely is, like, the passage of time is on your side the entire time. So basically, once they hit that kind of 6 to 9 month range, things are going to get kind of challenging. Depending on whether they are intact or not, things might get more challenging for a minute before they get better. If they've been pediatrically spayed or neutered, probably not. Probably 6 to 9 months is going to be the worst of it. If you've got some good help and you are proceeding kind of as you need to be with your training, things get better and better and better as they get older. Where I see things be, you know, when that's not true is when you don't dig into the things that you need to work on or get the good help when you need it, when they're around 9 or 10 months. So if you're seeing something that you're going, I don't know how to handle this, get somebody to help you handle it. Like, don't worry about it. Just get somebody to help you handle it. And then things, I almost feel like they plateau for a while. I almost feel like it's just kind of a lot of work for a minute. And then it being like a year, and then it starts to get better around 18 months to 2 years. As well as I think, like, you get to know them as who they truly are. And for me, I really start to enjoy them a lot. As we kind of get through some of those tough moments and we survive them together, and we do, you know, this is where I encourage people to do training that isn't related to the behavior problem and isn't related to anything else, like going to nose work class and things like that, because it helps you to really have that bond. And that's especially true if you work with somebody on some behavior modification. Like, please, please do some fun things with the dog as well, because otherwise working with the dog will feel like a slog the entire time.
Yeah.
But yeah, they get better. And honestly, I've got a wide range of ages in my house. I've got a 9-month-old and I also have a 15-year-old. And 15-year-old was a complete nightmare as an adolescent. And 15 years ago, I was far less equipped than I am today. And I honestly, she was really, really hard. And I wouldn't trade her for anything, right? Mm. So I think we can get really mushy in the reality of, like, when you get through this and you have that adult dog, like, for me, a 4, 5, 6-year-old dog, there is nothing better. They are your best friend. They go everywhere. Like, you can have so many adventures. You can do so many cool things. You know each other so well. Like, that is what is on the other side of this hill. Like, it is going to be okay. It's going to be better than okay.
I couldn't agree more. Like, my dog is 5 now. She just turned 5 this month. And like, she is amazing. And she's my soulmate. And, you know, we got through some of those more challenging behaviors when she came in at, you know, teenager and to a whole new life. Yeah.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. And It is. There's nothing better than that's my favorite age of life. Like when people are like, I love puppies or I love them. I'm like, no, middle-aged, like four to eight, if you are lucky, like is the best.
Yeah.
Yeah. So and good.
I raised a human child. So like, I have to tell you, like, no, I was thinking about it this morning. I was like, nobody's like, I want to have an adolescent human. Everyone's like, I want to have a baby. Worst. You know, they think of like the little booties and the little cute blankets and stuff. And then I was like stunned that at like age 12, he was like, can you drop me like a block away from school so I could walk the rest of the way? I'm like, wait, what? And for a good like 6 years, I was like, so I guess you're just going to be this family member that we're really not that close. And I will just support you and help you in the things that you're interested in, but step back when needed, which was almost most of the time. I felt like he didn't want me involved. And now he's 22 and we're like best friends again. So it's very similar to humans.
It totally is. I haven't raised human children, but I was one. And I was, and I really had a very, very difficult time as a teenager. And I think it's just, it's relatable and you need to, I think there's a lot of parallels that we can draw. Like, yeah. No, this is no parent's favorite time either.
Yeah.
But supporting your kid through that stuff and kind of knowing that the dogs are the same. Like they don't want your help, but they do need your help. Yes. They're like, I got this. I know everything, but they're going to be grateful when they fall in the water and you pull them out by their harness. Like it is true that supporting them through these times will pay off and will matter because they will look to you for that later. But then it's going to be thankless for the time being. That's true.
I love it.
Oh my gosh. Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. This was a wonderful conversation, Sarah. Thank you so much. Where can our listeners find you online?
Thank you so much for having me. I love talking about these teenage dogs. Everything is at sarahstreming.com. I've got my online courses you can find through there. And then on social media, just to make it complicated, I'm doing something different everywhere. Facebook is The Cognitive Canine as well as Cog Dog Radio. That's my podcast, by the way, Cog Dog Radio. And then TikTok is my name at Sarah Streming. I'm actually chronicling a lot of Carson's adolescence on there. Instagram is cognitive_canine. And yeah, love to see you all in all of those channels.
And lovely. The course, can we just really, like, so the course is called Terrible Tyrants?
It's called Teenage Tyrants.
Teenage Tyrants. Okay. And it they is, can find that on the website.
Yes, it is a self-study course. It's got, I don't know, something like 16 modules or something, a bunch of videos. And also I have to plug my membership. You can join the membership and you will have access to the course through the membership, but you also have access to the community in the membership. And there's a lot of folks in there who are there because their dog is an adolescent. They need that help and that support. So there's a lot of folks in the community, in the membership talking about a lot of these challenges. And I will, of course, get all of that information for you guys.
Okay, awesome. We'll put all these links in the show notes.
Thank you so much for coming on. And we'll definitely invite you back in another season for other discussions.
I would love to. Thanks so much.
If you liked this episode, don't forget to rate and review. It helps other folks like you find the show. Thanks to Mike Pesci for the original music and James Eade of Be Heard for production. For show notes and transcripts, visit podtotherescue.com. Let us know what you think about this episode on social media. We're at Pod to the Rescue on Facebook and Instagram, and we love connecting with listeners. We'll catch you next time on Pod to the Rescue. Oh, and tell your dog we said hi.